right, that was Direct Control from the first LP. Song was called Brain Dead. If you didn't pick that up from the lyrics there, I almost played Ronnie's Dead. I think Brain Dead is a better song, but let's not forget that Ronald Reagan did die in 2004 in this decade, this last decade. Yeah, Ronnie is dead, folks. And Direct Control wrote a song about it. Before that, I started things off with a short two-song set with AT, Annihilation Time, from their second LP called the track Imaginary Mirror. Just, again, just amazing, mind-melting band, great track. Everything about it was just wild. So
wild and crazy.
Wild and crazy.
That's the only way Annihilation Time can be, and that's why we love them. All right. Thanks to Ryan and Fred for coming and rocking this Best of the Decade show at Maximum Rock and Roll Radio. Please send us any requests or questions to Maximum... blah, 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 blah. What is the website? I can't even remember what the... What is the email address? I can't even remember what
the... Email is radio@maximumrockandroll.com.
Thanks, I'm a dumbass.
Hey, that's all right.
Oh, look, it's right in front of me.
That's the only reason I knew.
Anyway, I've only been doing the radio show for like a bazillion years. You'd think I would have that shit memorized by now. Anyway, send us two copies of vinyl, CD-only releases, and cassettes to Maximum Rock and Roll, P.O. Box 460760, San Francisco, California, 94146. Going to close the set off with one of the bands that burned the brightest and the fastest. They put out two quick full-length LPs. This song makes me want to break shit. This is Cold Sweat doing Fuck the Flock.
And now, stay tuned for Tim and the Gang on Maximum Rock and Roll.
Good afternoon and welcome to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. I'm Janaea and I'm going to be your host today. And co-hosting with me is Hope for Peace. And we've got a great lineup of guests today. For the first hour, we're going to be speaking with Mimi Edgar and Pat Hardy of Alternatives to Violence Project. And we'll be learning about their work in prisons and within in our community. And then from 3 to 4, we'll be speaking with Kim Rosen. She's a poet of peace. She's written Saved by a Poem. And then from 4 to 5, we'll be speaking with three local artists about a show that they're going to be having this Sunday from 3 to 5 at Samadhi. And it's a gathering of four nations. And it's going to be very heartfelt and ceremonial. But right now, I'm dedicating this segment to Chief Joseph, and I Will Fight No More Forever. This is dedicated to all the indigenous people and peoples throughout the world that have lost their land and their traditions. Yes, today we do live in a violent society, and violence comes in many forms. People are shocked by the increasing violence in the streets, in our schools, and homes. Violence knows no class, racial, economic, or geographical boundaries. People in the U.S. have twice the chance of being murdered than in many other Western countries. Our schools have resorted to metal detectors, violence in the home, physical and mental, directed against both spouse and child is rampant. We lead the world in prison population, and our prisons, rather than protecting society from violence, spawn more violence. Over 90% of prisoners eventually return to society from a prison experience that encourages violence. Today we're going to learn what Alternatives to Violence Project is doing to help make a change. It's a grassroots international volunteer movement committed to reducing interpersonal violence in our society, and it works towards this goal by presenting experiential workshops in prisons, schools, and within our communities. They present conflict management skills and enable individuals to build successful interpersonal interactions, gain insights in themselves, and find new and positive approaches to their lives. And today, I've asked Mimi Edgar. She's been a school teacher locally. She lives here in Santa Cruz, and she teaches at New Brighton School. Hi.
Hi.
Welcome, Mimi.
Thank you.
She'll be sharing with us, and my co-host is Hope for Peace. She's
greetings,
back.
Santa Cruz.
And then online, we have Pat Hardy. And let me make sure she's here. Pat, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Great. Welcome. It's such an honor to have you both. I just want to say a little bit about Pat, too. Let's see. Pat, you've been with AVP for how many years?
About 19.
Wow. That's quite a while. And you started with a bed and breakfast professional association. You were an innkeeper, and you created that association.
Right.
And then in 1990, you started volunteering with AVP workshops, and you facilitated in 10 prisons and communities off and on since that time. And isn't AVP largely volunteers, too?
Yes, all volunteers.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess I'd like to start with, Pat, what is the history of Alternatives to Violence?
Well, it's a very exciting history. It started off in the 70s. Of course, the 70s were powerful times in this country for progressive kinds of things. And it was started by a group of inmates who were frustrated in Greenhaven Prison in New York that their children and the kids coming into the prison were just so unable to find ways other than violence to solve their problems. And they said, we don't have the skills to do that either. Would you work with us? And they went to a group of Quakers who were presently in the prison at that point in time and said, would you please, let's work on something together that we can create, that can create alternatives to violence, thus the name. And so the program grew from there. It's now in something like 42 countries and 27 states.
Wow.
And it's been functioning in Rwanda and Burundi and other places that that have hit the news that have been struggling with genocide.
It's the tentacles reach far and wide. And it's so successful. We need it now more than ever with the conflict and the economic collapse and the chaos that so many are experiencing. Mm-hmm. It's probably just growing by leaps and bounds. And what, either one of you can address this, but what do you attribute its success to? It's volunteer. You know, a lot of people don't have time for volunteer activities. I actually volunteered at San Quentin, and it was truly transformative, and just want to say one more thing, and then I'll let you speak. It speaks, I, for lack of a better term, I call it soft power. It has a way of transforming the heart so that one feels more powerful within, and there's a spiritual power that opened up for me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to address that at all? Go
ahead, I just want to say, I think the one word that makes it so successful is that it is experiential. You know, we don't stand in front, we don't lecture, we don't, the men will tell us, this is unlike any workshop I've ever taken. I go to NAAA, you know, Breaking Barriers, Anger Management, and because AVP is experiential, you know, you experience it, and that's what makes it successful for all the participants, including the facilitators who come in. Because we get this great experiential workshop. Each time we do it, it's different. You know, we do many of the same exercises, but because of, you know, we're all going through this together, and it creates a really strong community. And I think that's what it is. It's just very different.
And the same exercises are conducted, but it's the unique individuals.
Exactly.
And it's a format that's established, from what I understand. But somehow the magic continues
to
happen.
Right. Yeah, because each person brings his own, you know, or her own experiences and goes through something during the workshop. It's really amazing. What do you think, Pat? Why is it so successful?
I think, part of it, the reason it's successful is that it works. There was some research done in Delaware on recidivism, the return to prison rate. And if the person took a life skills class, just a basic life skills class, there was a 17.8% recidivism rate compared to ABP, which was a 9.9% recidivism rate. So there's almost half as much difference. And within 3 years after they've left prison, with only having taken a basic workshop, the recidivism rate is 37%. Now in California at this point it's 70%.
Wow, that's so high.
Mm-hmm. That's terrible.
Yeah.
I had no idea. Well, can you describe what actually, either one of you, what actually happens in a workshop to give our listeners an idea?
You want to start, Pat?
Sure. We start off with one that I think is a really wonderful example, and that's we have everybody who comes into the workshop has an adjective name. So what we do is we ask them to take the first initial of their first name and create a positive adjective for themselves. Now that can have also, it can be funny Fred or something spelled with a PH, so it sounds like it. But what happens is when they come in, in the prison yard, they are always their last name or some derogatory name. And they come here with us in the workshop. They take on the name that their mother gave them.
Mm-hmm.
And they then use this same adjective. It's like affirmations that we use frequently in the outside world, that they say, that they keep saying this positive thing about themselves every time they speak. They're part of our requirements are that they say their adjective name. Mm-hmm. And they remind one another, and that becomes their moniker when they go out into the yard. And we hear all kinds of stories of how one of their fellow workshop AVPers is in the yard and is starting to get hot under the collar with somebody else, and somebody else will come up and say their adjective name, at which point it puts them right back into the workshop.
And you know, it's a very simple exercise, but it really is powerful, because many of the men will say, this is the first time I've heard that name since I was a kid.
Wow.
You know, they take on these nicknames that they use out, you know, in their gang world or whatever, and then all of a sudden they are able to connect with that innocent, you know, early person they were at one time. It's amazing, that one simple thing.
And I imagine you see it in their faces. Their eyes probably soften, and there's more enthusiasm.
Yeah. And many of the men will laugh because they've never heard someone else's first name. And someone will say it, and they all laugh, and they go, you're kidding. Is that your name? You know, it breaks the ice.
I actually did it the first workshop in San Quentin, and for some reason I kept the name Silly Cindy. Mm-hmm. I'm also called Cindy. Cindy Janae at Barry's, whoever's listening with me or on with me. And one of the guys said, you can't be Silly Cindy. No, he wanted me to have another name. He was adamant that it not be silly. Well, it stuck, and mm-hmm. I insisted for a lot of reasons. I was too serious. But the connection that he had with my name somehow had quite an impact on him, and he was very protective. And then we did a role play where I was being arrested, and he was my big brother. And I felt like it was really happening right mm-hmm. there. And I had never experienced anything like that. And do you have any examples that are similar? How my heart, it just felt, all of a sudden I felt like I was walking in his sister's shoes. And this did happen to his sister.
Well, role-playing is one of the parts of the workshop. And many times, you know, they do bring up real-life situations, and we try to work through them. How could have this been resolved differently? And we ask people not to take a role that they would have in real life. So, you know, if they want to work out something that's happening in their life, they won't play themselves. They might play the other person, you know, just because people do get involved emotionally in some of these role plays. Other things we do in the workshop is, you know, we have many exercises we do. We focus on affirmation exercises to begin with, ones that build community. And we go into iMessages, you know, some communication skills. And then we also have in every session, each workshop is broken into sessions.
Mm-hmm.
There's an activity called the Light and Lively, which is just
that?
It's just a fun thing that you do. It gets people moving and laughing, and they'll say, gee, I haven't laughed like this since I was a kid, you know. One of them is it's called Big Wind Blows, and everybody sits in a circle. Yeah. And someone has to stand in the middle and say a big wind blows for anybody who, and then he'll say something that pertains to him, like anybody who has a child. Then anyone else in the circle who has a child has to get up, move to another seat, and there's one less seat for the number of people. And whoever's left out has to go in the middle and do that. And at first, you know, they might be reluctant, but after a while, they just love it. They get into these fun activities. So, you know, each section of the workshop is balanced between serious and more playful. And
that's a great balance. I did it in 95, so I'm a little foggy in my memory. And when I was doing it, community members came in from outside to be with the inmates. And then the inmates were also trained as facilitators. So they worked together, the community facilitators as well as
yes.
And that's still the format.
Mm-hmm. There are three levels of workshop. You take a basic, and then if you want, you can take an advanced, and then you can go on to a training for facilitators. And, yes, so we have trained inside facilitators. So when I go That's into the wonderful. Prison now, you know, I often will be the only outside person coming in, and I'll have three inmates on my team helping me facilitate the workshop. It's really wonderful.
And it gives them, I imagine, a greater sense of pride.
Oh, yeah,
and
absolutely.
And sense of self. It shifts their whole identity and very well their lives. And so many prison inmates are coming out now of prison because of the economic crisis in California. So they're being emptied.
I think that's more a rumor than a fact.
Oh.
I don't think that's a fact.
Oh. Well, I've just, it is a rumor then.
Yeah.
They're talking about it, but we're not.
It hasn't happened yet.
No, but the men are I see a sense of hope in many of them, and they're wanting to have a different life when they get out. And so I think this rumor has been really good. We'll see what happens. But inside, at least, they're thinking, you know, wow, there's a chance. And they really want a fresh start.
Yeah.
So AVP helps with that.
And is there a community within the prison of AVP graduates or those that have participated?
Absolutely. Yeah. They see themselves as part
Support
of it. In
group.
Some prisons, we hand out pins that then they wear, and they can identify other people who on the yard who've taken the workshop. In some prisons also, we are offering support groups where someone from the community or someone within a sponsor within the prison works with those who are already facilitators to lead an hour and a half or 2 hour mini workshop and practice
session
so that they have an opportunity to do that. That's not possible everywhere because we don't have volunteers everywhere, enough volunteers to be able to make that happen.
And what has the prison administration been saying about the program? Have they wanted to be a part of it too, or?
Well, I think it varies prison to prison. I work at Salinas Valley State Prison, and the warden is very supportive. And I've also worked at the prison right next door. There are two of them in Soledad, right next door to each other. It's called Central Training Facility, and the warden there is very supportive. But I think it varies, right, Pat? There are certain prisons where they're not welcoming the program.
Well, in most places, they're eager to have us. The department administration has been very eager to have it. We're free, and they actually see changes. A couple of quotes from different prisons. When we first started in Chuckawalla, we'd been there. We had trained about 300 men. This is in Blythe, and we had volunteers traveling anywhere from 4 to 6 hours to go there and facilitate workshops. What happened there is they tracked those people, the first 300, and they found only two of them had any kind of write-up, demerit, or whatever you would call it, and that whole group. So then in Susanville, which is a pretty high-level prison, not the high desert, but the pretty high-level prison, one of the associate wardens said, you know, this is the quietest, last summer was the quietest summer they've ever had in that prison, and he accounts it significantly to having AVP on the yard.
It's, tremendous.
Yeah, so I think that the wardens overall are in favor of it and are seeking it. I have five prisons on my list who would like to have us now, and we do not have the volunteer people to do it. So we haven't run out of prisons to go into yet.
No, and you also do it in communities.
We do it in communities because the community people are needed to be able to go in, as well as some places do youth work with young people with AVP, and they also end up supporting the local prison.
Wow. Well, how has it been transformative for people? Or for you, how did it work for you, Mimi or Pat? What happened to you, and how did you get involved?
Well, I took my first workshop here in Santa Cruz. I heard about it through the meeting. I'm an active member of the local Quaker meeting, and there was a group of us and some other people who were not in the meeting, and we did the training, and some of the facilitators were just, they were amazing people. And I thought, wow. Yeah. And they talked about their prison work, and that just piqued my interest from the very beginning. And so my husband and I, we're doing this together. We decided, well, let's do the next level of training. So we did. And then we did the third. And then we were invited to go into San Quentin. That was our first workshop. Maybe, I think that was around 97. And oh my gosh, you know, it was amazing. Well, you know, cause you went.
I do. Yeah. It changed my life.
and oh my gosh, it's, you know, it was an amazing weekend. And we thought, well, this is great, because you really feel like you're doing something. You know, the men are so grateful. Oh. They just tell you over and over, thank you so much. You know, it's nice for us to know that people outside do care.
Yes.
And they don't all think we're worthless. And, you know, it's wonderful. And then for a while, there was a lack of AVP in the prisons. And then about 5 years ago, Pat, when they had when Jeannie Wolford invited...
Right. Right. It was about, I think it was 2005, so almost 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, she was the...
Jelly Bean.
No, this is...
No, she's the warden.
Oh.
The warden. She was the former warden of San Quentin, who then became head of the Department of Corrections. And because San Quentin had such an active AVP program for quite a while, she saw firsthand the results, and she invited a group of AVP facilitators to come and do some exercises with the wardens. Now, Pat, were you one of those people?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Pat, tell us about that.
Well, she had had a very positive experience when she was at San Quentin. And I'll get back to that because there's an interesting story there. And she, we made an appointment, went through Friends Committee on Legislation, and made an appointment, and went to see her, prepared all these materials, and we walked in, and we were sitting, and she walked in, and she looked at us. I know, I don't need all this. I know AVP is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Her word. And she says, I want you to meet all the wardens. Every prison should have this program.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to their wardens meeting, which we'd never done before, and 22 of the 33 wardens signed up to have us in their program. Well, needless to say, we were in, at that point, one prison, and we had to gear up. So at that point in 2005, we then started gearing up. We're now in 17 prisons in California.
That's amazing.
It is. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't even tell you how many we're actually in, because many of those prisons were in 2 yards, and in California, the prisons are so large that you have to count each yard almost as a prison
if
you look at the rest of the country. So
there
were probably more in like 25.
Yeah,
if you count that. But the story that's interesting is that I, at the same time that we went to speak to Jeannie, to the wardens, one of the women who was a warden at that time was at the bar after the meeting. I think this is the way it happened, this is the way it came to me. And Jeannie was telling about a time when she first went to San Quentin. AVP, they told her, the department told her, you have to eliminate all programs. So by the time this story happened, there was no AVP active on the prison grounds. And there was a rumble or a riot beginning to foment on the yard.
Wow.
The guys were going into their racial groups, or their gangs of whatever those were, and taking off their shirts and starting to flex muscle. And one of the AVPers, and there was a song that particular group sang all the time, started singing that song. All I want from you is to remember me as loving you.
Mm. Oh, my goodness.
They put their shirts back on, and they went back to their cell.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic.
Word.
So if it helps, if you want any proof that it helps prison, that's the story.
Yeah, that's big.
Well, growing up, we're really not given many tools to know how to work with conflict at all, or to understand how to communicate well, or take any other path than what we see on TV or in the movies most of the time. So it's exciting to think that even giving someone a really small tool helps them so much, because they have no tools at all. And most of us, even no matter where you are, I think very few of us probably really have those tools naturally. We just don't learn it when we're growing up. So opening their eyes even just a little bit and giving them something else to use, that's just wonderful.
And you address, too, excuse me, the violence within ourselves, not what we'd usually consider violence.
That's right.
Do you want to say a little
more?
Yeah,
I do. One of the exercises we do, it's called brainstorm. It's a brainstorm on violence and nonviolence. And we just put up a big sheet of paper and we ask them in, okay, let's brainstorm. What's violence? And they start throwing out everything, you know, rape, discrimination, you know, just everything goes up there from actions to attitudes. And we just put it all up there. And then we do the same thing for nonviolence and hugs, smiles, you know, everything goes up there. And, you know, it's really eye-opening for them to just look at the two lists. One man sat there, I'll never forget, and he just looked at him and he had this look on his face. And I said, what are you thinking? He just said, I never knew the nonviolence growing up. He looked at the list. He said he never got the hugs, the kisses, the everything that was there, you know, the forgiveness. He said, I only know the other. And for many of these men, that's the reality, you know. Like, not only are they not taught how to deal with conflict, but they're taught how to be violent. I mean, that's what they see in their life every day. And it's amazing. So, yeah, they start looking at things differently, like, oh, wow, that is violence, isn't it? You know?
And it must be a bit scary for them, too, after being in the cocoon of the workshop, to go back into the prison system at large with other inmates that haven't been in the training. So they really have to be able to draw upon what they gained there.
Yeah.
And the fact that they have other people in that community who can support them in what they want to do.
Yeah, they will often say that in the last, before we, you know, end the workshop, they'll say, you know, now you guys come up to me anytime you want, you know, you can talk to me, and I'm always there for you, and, you know, we really form a strong community just in one weekend,
yes.
And they do have each other, and, you know, we've done, I think now in Salinas Valley, gosh, I wish I had the exact figure, but close to 500 people, I think, now have gone through. Over 300, mm-hmm. whatever, I don't know. But it makes a huge difference.
Yes.
Yeah. It changes the whole climate there.
Probably others are asking, what happened to you, man? I want some of this.
They do.
In the website, I read something that inmates will take the workshop because they feel it will help their chances of getting out sooner. Then they take it, and they really want to be involved without any points. They just want the involvement. Excuse me. Well, how do you initially bring people on from the community, because it is all volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all volunteers. I don't know if you even have paid staff. Mm-hmm.
How do you get your word out?
That's a struggle. Yeah, that's hard.
It's a one-by-one kind of process. Mm-hmm. You can advertise, you can do things. And this kind of thing really helps, because it really helped to create a workshop in San Luis Obispo and also in the Bay Area.
Great.
So we really appreciate this. This is very helpful, but it's such a hard thing to describe, and when mm-hmm. you start relating it to prison, you cut down the number of people who are interested. And there are so many things happening out in the community that they figure, oh, I've done that, or I'm not violent. And the fact is, we all end up at some point yelling, if not verbally, at the driver in front of us, or the person who's been rude to us at the store, or mm-hmm. and all that kind of violence we learn to control, or we wish we could control it better so it doesn't eat on us.
Mm-hmm.
We're hardly any of us are good at forgiveness.
Yeah.
And the whole issue of empathy is the huge base that all this rises on. Because if you don't have a sense that other people also have feelings and begin to feel what those other people's feelings are, there really is no way to really begin communicating with them. But that's hard to communicate to the community.
You know, where I work on my staff, people know I do this and they'll express interest, but, well, I don't have time. You know, I talk at every opportunity I have to people that I know, and I invite them, and I have, like, right now 4 excellent prospects, but they've yet to actually, you know, find the time to do it. So it is difficult. There are 8 of us who are right now working in the two prisons in Soledad. And, you know, that's not that many people. You know, you think AVP, oh, it's this big organization. Yeah. There are eight of us, four of us, five of us now live in Santa Cruz. Two live in Pacific Grove, and one woman lives in Aromas, and that's it. And so we're trying to, and as Pat mentioned earlier, these prisons have yards. So CTF has a central and a north yard, and Salinas Valley has an A yard, a B yard. And each one of these is like a different facility, and to try to service
them
all, it's overwhelming. Yeah,
different levels of security.
Well, mostly they don't ever talk to each other. So you can't have train a group of facilitators in yard A, and then they can go on to facilitate in yard B. They don't do that.
Yeah,
because they have to go through a whole big thing that they call an enemy check.
You know what happened to me? I was a little nervous, I'll admit, when I first went into a prison. But now, when someone tells me they were in prison, I just say, oh, because of my incredible bonding with everyone there, prisoners and staff, community. Their ability to express their pain and work through it, the courage that it took, just opened my heart, and that's always with me now. And I don't know where you can go to have an experience like that. The empathy, exactly.
I think that if more people just went in once, they would definitely be hooked. You know, like, oh, this is great. But it's hard to get people to commit to, because you have to take a weekend out of your life.
That's true.
And, you know, people are very busy. And right now it seems especially hard with, you know, the economy being what it is. People are just trying to survive on the outside. And
I know.
It's hard to get people involved.
But, you know, for me, when I was working full-time, and I'm now doing this full-time, when I was working full-time and traveling the country, I was going to Lompoc then. I would go into Lompoc, and it was like this huge personal vacation retreat because not only did I get an opportunity to participate in the workshop and do all the deep, meaningful things that happened in the workshop, but I didn't have any phone calls. I didn't have to answer anybody's questions about bed and breakfast. I was on a team, so it was really very secure. We only do it as a team, not as a person who has to be responsible for everything. And it was like being welcomed home.
Yeah.
And being able to be myself in a different way than I am other places.
Because you speak such truth. You're encouraged to look inside of yourself in ways that we don't have that opportunity ordinarily.
That's right.
No, exactly.
And I learned things about myself that I never knew.
Yeah.
How violent I can be towards myself in self-dialogue, for example, and then how that comes out in the world and how I filter my reality. I mean, we really looked at ourselves. It was deep work.
It is deep.
And then how to communicate in a way that is impactful, that where you're really being truthful. Are there any more exercises that you want to share? Because I don't remember the specifics, but I just know how I felt coming out.
Well, you know, one of the things that we do, opening each session after a break or whatever, is we do what we call a gathering or reentry. There are different names. And what we do is everything is done in a circle or divided into small groups. And in this case, in a gathering, and some of the questions that we ask really cause us to look at ourselves. What does something that my first experience with violence, what I expect from a friend. These are the kinds of questions.
What do I do when I am feeling depressed or low? And they learn from each other, you know?
Yeah.
It's like group therapy, but we don't do any therapy. In group therapy, you have an opportunity to hear somebody, everybody else's situation, and you learn from it. It's exactly the same thing.
One thing we haven't mentioned is we try to have the workshops racially balanced, which is really important.
Yeah.
And the people on the inside are the ones who, you know, help select the inmates. But it's really powerful because usually every workshop, at least one person will say at the end, you know, I've never just, last time this one man said, I've never really kicked it with the Mexicans. You know, this is really cool. Like, you know, they're just like me. I mean, you know, things that we take for granted. that they are experiencing for the first time. And there was this one young man, this was last year, and a Caucasian man, he had a swastika tattooed on his neck. Mm-hmm. So you saw it at all times. And he had changed from the time, from the person he was when he had the tattoo on, you know, put on. And he said, but, you know, he wanted it there to remind himself of who he used to be. And it was kind of a form of atonement that he was, you know, paying by just having it there and having to say, yes, this is who I was, and always working against being that person again. And then in the workshop, wow, we always mix people randomly. So there was this elderly black gentleman, and for some reason, he and this young man would get paired up just randomly. And then we would, you know, different activities, ask you to share different things about your life. And so this happened. Okay, the first workshop ended. And then they both, for some reason, ended up in the second level workshop, because usually those are also, they're not always, very rarely, the same people who were in the first one together. There's a pool, and then we pick from those, and those who are available come. They were in the second workshop together, and then they ended up in the third training. And at the beginning, they shared something which was so moving. I mean, several of us were crying. This young man said, you know what, I have to tell you, when I came to the first workshop, he said, I didn't really mix with blacks at all, and I kept getting thrown in with this gentleman here. And he said, I want to tell you something now. He said, he's my best friend. And wow. And the elderly man just kind of nodded. He said, yeah, you know, if I need to talk to someone, I go to him. And, you know, it was amazing. And those are the kinds of things that we hear that keep us going back. You know, you asked about the success. And the men, when you said you share so deeply yourself, they'll say in front of everybody, you know, I've never said this before. I've never told anyone. And they really open up. And it's very moving. Yeah. It's really very moving.
Because who doesn't have deep pain just in the process of living, and, you know, to find a safe place to let it out? That's transformative. Mm-hmm. And can you say a little bit about the spiritual power? And I love what you just shared before you say that, because I bet there are many examples of that. And it illustrates what happens to deep friendships. You know, the same blood curses through all of us.
That's right.
That's what the elders always say, and it's true.
Well, when we stop to think about it, we realize that one of our main needs as humans is that human contact. Mm-hmm. We need that so much. And really, from the beginning, we don't take care of that at all. In fact, the violent ways that we have separate us from that. Mm-hmm. And so we miss out on that altogether. And it's neat to think that just a little of that contact is so transformative. Mm-hmm. Because in some of the other things that we do, like, for instance, alcoholism, you really got to work at it, you know, to make some kind of progress like that.
There
it's
can be
difficult,
judgment.
Very difficult. But in this kind of situation, that immediate feeling of, wow, you know, I really like this. I feel close to this person. It's kind of an immediate thing that nature does for us to try to, you know, get that going. It's wonderful to turn our focus and attention to that, because we don't think about it enough.
And as we continue, as these workshops continue, that's one more person out in the world who knows this way of being.
Fantastic.
To bring it out. But what can you say about the, I keep going back, this, the transformative spiritual soft power. How would you describe that? It was on your website. Either one of you, Pat or Mimi.
Pat, you want to go ahead first?
Where is it here?
I think that the important thing is that transforming power is really the spiritual base for this. And it is the base it is the basis on which we look towards being open to a new way. And let me give you some examples. Things that we look at in terms of guidelines for transforming power. Getting this out just as you started this, but I frequently explain transforming power, and I got this from another person, from George Ramos. He said, the transforming power is that tapping into that the knowledge of the whole world and into the truth of the other people in the group. Mm. And it's like having that radio sitting in the middle of the room, but it's not plugged in. And I plug that in. I'm the radio, and I plug that in. And I'm able then, at that point, to really come in touch with a much greater knowledge than I have on my own, and a much, much bigger world than I have on my own. And so I look at transforming power as an opportunity to touch that goodness in everyone. There are four basic premises of transforming power, and one is everyone has an inner goodness, and that in every conflict situation there is a possibility for a nonviolent solution. In order to change situations in positive ways, we start with ourselves, and nonviolent conflict resolution is a skill. It's something that improves with practice and persistence. And we'll do it the rest of our lives, like all kinds of growth things. And some of the things that we, some of the different terminologies that we look at and that we ask about is that this is a power that we don't use, but that uses us. That we're open to this to transform power when we're faced with a difficult situation. And the stories that happen, and each person who ends up being a facilitator has a couple of stories that happen and that have happened to them where they have allowed transforming power to come in and to make changes in their lives. And it's simple things like seek to resolve conflicts by reaching common ground, reach for that something in others that seeks to do good for yourself and for others, listen, base your position on truth. I mean, these are not earth-shattering, but when you put them all together and you try to apply them, and you feel good about yourself in applying them, a lot of change can happen in your life.
And that, go ahead.
I was just going to say one of the points too of transforming power is respect for self, you know, and many of the men they've never had respect for themselves. They don't, and they're finally realizing that I wouldn't be here. If I respected myself, if I didn't put myself in that position, you know, caring for others is another part of it. Expecting the best. And they just kind of look at you like, what? I said, I was told to expect the worst, you know. So it's a whole new way of looking at things and being open to solving things in a different way.
And it's such a gift that you're giving each individual. And yet we're human beings, and that's our birthright. To be living in this way, it's you're reminding us, and this process is reminding us. Could you give me any examples of how that soft power worked? You said that each facilitator has a few examples after every workshop. Either one of you can jump in, some that were most memorable for you.
Well, there was one in the last workshop I did, because the men have an opportunity to, one of the exercises we do is you share a conflict that you solve nonviolently, and they all have a story. We all do, you know. Yeah. We can come up with, oh yeah, I did that, you know, and then but you put it all together and they realize, wow, okay, and I've done this. I can do this again and again. One man told me, you know, you get good at what you practice. That was his little mantra. You get good at what you practice. He said, I'm good at violence. He said, I've practiced that a lot. So he said, now I got to practice this new way. Yeah. And anyway, so they tell these stories. And one person's story, I mean, most of them are amazing. He just, he stole a car. And he was supposed to drive it and pick up some drugs. And there were guys waiting for him back at wherever they were. And he got a phone call because there was the cell phone was in the car, and somebody called, and he was on his way to get the drugs, and the man was very respectful. He said, you know, I don't know you. My wife's going into labor. I need my car. Could you please just bring the car back? And it touched a part of this man, and he took the car. He not only took the car. He said he got gas in the car, took it back, apologized, and then he left. You know. And his friends could not believe it. Like, you'd what? But, you know, They all think, and you know, we all have these experiences where we just were open to, I think what Pat said, the empathy, when you can feel empathy for another person, and, you know, it was...
You both are doing an amazing job describing and explaining what I found in, I couldn't describe, and I usually have words, but I was at a loss, so this is really helpful.
It helps to have you have taken the workshop.
Yes.
And ask such great questions.
Well, that's what struck me was the actual transformation, the transformational aspect, and how it allowed my thoughts to shift. It was as if I had a groove, a pattern of thoughts that were repetitive and not real helpful in my life. And after experiencing this, I had this empty mind. And I felt more gentle with myself, more forgiving, and with others, to put it simply. And I didn't know how it happened. That's why I asked you here. No. Tell me what happened to me many years ago. No, I just, we have about 10 more minutes. So before we go on, I just want to make sure that our listeners know what the website is and how they can get a hold of either one of you or someone, how they can get involved in AVP.
Yeah. Well,
before we get.
Yeah. If you live in the Santa Cruz area, I'm in the phone book. Under Edgar, Mimi, and Alan, please call me. I'd love to invite you in. We're going again in January. We try to do one workshop a month. It's not always possible because I am still teaching full-time. My husband's still... Most of us involved locally are still working full-time, so it's hard. But the more... You know, my vision is that we have a large group of volunteers. We can have a vital program going in the prison, but it's not taxing any one of us. Because there have been times when I've planned to go in, I wanted to, and then I got sick or something happened and couldn't. And, you know, I would like to see a thriving program. So call me. I'd be happy to tell you how you can get involved. What I'll do is I'll invite you in. And it's very simple. You know, to go to Salinas Valley, you just fill out two pieces of paper, mail them in, that's it. And then, you know, we talk about...
You do have to go through a security check.
Right, when you get there, yeah. I mean, we talk about what you can and can't wear and what you can take in. There are certain guidelines that way. But as far as getting approval to go in, as long as you know you have a clean record, it's really simple. And we go in and you spend the weekend. You can decide, you know, if it's for you or not. But
you don't have to stay there, though. I mean, they're in the prison.
right.
We get out. You can stay with friends in the community or go home or
And then Pat can
whatever.
Talk about the website.
Here's an 800 number that you can call, and I can pass this on to Mimi. 800-905-6765. 800-905-6765. And if you want to find more about us, we're on the website, www.avp, A as in alternatives, V as in violence, P as in project, California, all written out, .org. avpcalifornia.org, and you can contact us by email through that too. And I can see that it gets to Mimi if I receive all those.
And how would you summarize what happens to the volunteers as they participate? And maybe they don't even want to go into prisons. They can just take the workshop locally in their community. And how would you, I mean, we've said so much. How can we summarize what actually happens?
I think what happens for community volunteers is they get a much broader picture of their community. If you take a community workshop or you take one in the prison, you begin to know more about our society and what's happening in our society.
Mm-hmm.
You also begin to look at your place in our society. At least this is what I end up doing over and over. And I also, it's a constant reminder of, oh, I could have handled that situation differently.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I would have liked to have learned how to do this one, and checking it, and you know, just constantly looking at how I'm relating to other people, and learning about my impact on other people. It's a very powerful part of the workshop.
There's such important questions that we just don't consider as much as we should. We really appreciate you bringing them forward today. Yeah, I have two teenage boys, and actually they do fairly well. But I'm fantasizing about getting them into one of the workshops, not because they necessarily even have issues with violence, you know, on a daily basis, but just in their going about and learning how to deal with people and having a boss, and you know, soon you're going to be having a wife, and you know, I feel like I haven't given them the tools really to be able to deal with things terribly successfully.
And there is a program for youth.
Oh, wonderful.
Isn't
for
there?
Teenagers. Wonderful.
It's called HIP. Yeah.
HIP.
Wow. Help. Neat.
Help increase the peace.
Oh, wonderful. And does that have a website, or is that found also on the website you mentioned earlier?
What do you know, Pat, about HIP? How someone would contact? I don't.
You can use the same number.
Oh, there you go.
800-905-6765.
Super.
And we can put together a youth workshop. At this point, there isn't anything in the Santa Cruz area that I know of.
Yeah, it'd be really valuable.
And it really depends on other people putting together the workshop. And we can provide people to come and facilitate it. But at this point, there aren't any programs that I know of. Most of the programs that have happened in California have happened as a result of an individual saying, I want that to happen. Can you set it up? Can you send me people to do it? And we can do that.
Wow, that's a good one.
And what I love about it, too, is it's international. And you go into conflict zones.
Mm-hmm.
It's for... It's just... It has like a fire starter. It just keeps going and going.
Maybe it should be required for anyone in government.
We'll see again at the issue there of volunteer, though. Volunteerism. I mean, everybody, that's a real important part of AVP. Everybody has to be a volunteer.
And why is that?
Because you're there because you want to be, you know. And it's very powerful. I mean, if I were paid to go into the prison, I don't think the program would have as much impact. When the men hear that I'm there because I want to be, and often they'll ask me the first, what do you get out of this? You know, one of our first sessions. Why do you do this? And I said, just wait till the end and you'll know. And then at the end, they know. You know, it's like what I get out of it, how I feel. I feel very appreciated.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I'm making a difference. I'm not just sitting at home grousing about what's going on in the prisons or whatever, you know. It's like you feel like you're impacting people one-on-one. And and so it's very powerful to be a part of it.
And
the other reason that we have in prison is that we are not connected with the prison. We don't receive prison funding, and so that we are independent, and they don't control our program. So that's a part of why we are beyond the inmate commitment, the inmate really understanding why we're there. But they really appreciate it at a way different level because they trust us more because we're not paid.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is we are, one of the things we're looking at now, and actually AVP California has had this available, is that sometimes when we have community workshops, our national requirement is that you have to be all volunteer in a prison. But there's no statement on the community workshops. And sometimes we have parolees, or we have people who are financially not able to pay for the workshop, or who are financially a hardship in order to facilitate. And we have funds that we call lost wages, or we can pay their transportation and their lodging, which we frequently do in prisons where they're traveling, like to Susanville, and their food. So depending on the person's needs, they can request that. It's not a very big pool of money, but it is a philosophy that we've taken a very strong picture of. And HIP actually does started off paying youth to facilitate so that they could have a different kind of status doing it. They could afford to do it. They didn't have to have they could come and do the workshop and take off from whatever job they have. Or could help to pay for the child care that they might have had to provide while they were off doing the workshop.
And if people were paid, it would be a lot more expensive.
Oh, yes. This
gives it that ability to be flexible and go everywhere and anywhere. It's your heart that you're bringing.
Right.
We're
could never have expanded the way we have if we had to depend on paying people.
Mm-hmm. What a wonderful, wonderful service, too. Thank you so much. It's a part of our, a group of us, you know, that are for whatever reasons, really in a different situation. But we kind of forget people there in prison.
Yes, we do.
It's almost like they're not,
it's a tragedy,
they're just,
and so many
they've gone off into a hole, so to speak. And, and thank you so much for the work that you do there.
Well, I really feel like it's a, I'm honored to do the work. I really am.
Yeah.
And I just, I wish, I want to share that joy with other people, you know, so I hope this has piqued some people's interest here.
And that's how I felt going, and I do want to go back in January.
Oh, good.
I really do. Maybe Hope and I can start together.
Oh, fun. Okay. Yeah, it becomes like a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah.
They feed you and you feed them. And
yeah.
And that's how the circle should be.
And we're going to have to end at the circle, but I want to thank you both.
Well, can I say the telephone number one more time?
Oh, of course, and the website. I want all of that. Yeah.
800.
Okay.
800-905-6765 and abpcalifornia.org.
Wonderful.
And thank you so much. And I can
thank you.
I can testify to the truth and the soft power that cuts through anything that limits us or that prevents us from really connecting with ourselves and others, and the Creator.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You.
Bless your day.
All right.
Have a wonderful holiday.
Thank you, and you too. Bye. Okay, well, that was Mimi Edgar and Pat Hardy from Alternatives to Violence. And we're going to have Kim Rosen on, Saved by a Poem, who I spoke about. But in the meantime, I'm just going to play a little bit of a Wisdom Warrior meditation. Thank you. Wow, welcome again. That's the Wisdom Warrior, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. And we're always looking for donations, and you can make those to FRSC PO Box 7811 Santa Cruz. And we're in the middle still of Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. And I am real excited to have Kim Rosen here with us in the studio. She came down from, I believe, Marin, Kim. And she is the author of Saved by a Poem, The Transformative Power of Poetry. And I just want to say a little bit about this from her website. And in these times of global and personal uncertainty, why turn to poetry? In her book, Saved by a Poem, she reveals how a poem can be a companion through difficulty, acting as a guide when we are lost, a salve when we are wounded, and a conduit to insight, freedom, and joy. Kim is also a spoken word artist and a teacher of self-transformation. She's the co-creator of several CDs of poetry and music, most recently, Only Breath, an interweaving of music and mystical poems from around the world. She's given many poetry concerts, lectures, and workshops from cathedrals to juvenile lockdown facilities. Wow, that's quite a number. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Welcome. It's a pleasure to be here with both
sure.
of you.
Sure. And I want to play one of your CDs. And what was the name of this?
This is
beautiful?
From the CD Only Breath, composed by Jamie Sieber. And this particular CD has lots of fantastic musicians on it. It's also got the poem Dance with the Bandage Torn Off by Rumi.
Oh,
so the name of the name of the track is Inside the Soul. The name of the CD is Only Breath. The composer's Jamie Sieber. I'm the spoken word artist, and the poem is by Rumi, translated by Coleman Barks.
And what is the name of it once more?
Inside the Soul is the name of the track.
Wonderful.
Let's see if we can get this on now.
There it is.
Oh, I can hear it.
Dance when you're broken open. Dance if you've torn the bandage off. Dance in the middle of the fighting. Dance in your blood. Dance when you're perfectly free.
mostly to lies and cynical jokes. There are other things to see and hear.
Powerful.
Quite a collaboration of artists there.
Yeah, that was Ulali. The singers are a First Nation group of three amazing women. They call themselves Ulali, and you may have heard them in other ways. They have their own CDs, and they are also featured on my favorite CD of all time, One Giant Leap. They're an amazing gift, and a lot of other wonderful musicians. Jamie Sieber on electric cello, Kai Eckert on bass, Evan Schiller on percussion, and a bunch of other musicians on that CD. And I was speaking, as I said, a poem written by Rumi in the 12th century and translated by Coleman Barks, luckily for us, in the 20th century.
That was an amazing piece of music. I didn't expect that. And you know, you write about not just memorizing a poem, but embodying it and living it. And I just want to ask you what the difference is. I was memorizing a poem, and then what happened to you when this poem saved your life?
Yeah, well, many, many poems have saved my life. And the interesting thing is that when I talk to people who, even many people who say, I never read poetry. I don't relate to poetry. Almost everybody has a poem that saved their life at some point.
Can you say more about that?
Of a poem. You know, somebody will say, "Oh, I never listened to poetry." Well, there is this little ratty index card that I carry around in my purse. Yeah, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? You know, that last line of Mary Oliver's poem, The Summer Day, and somebody heard it at a funeral or heard it at a baptism or at a wedding and wrote it down and stuffed it in their purse or put it up on their fridge. And So we're all infused with poetry, even if we call them lyrics to the songs that we love, even if we call it the prayers, you know, the Serenity Prayer that 12-step programs have made popular. Even if we call it, Sanskrit chanting, it's all poetry. And I think a lot of people don't realize how interwoven with the poetic word we all are. So you asked me about memorizing, and I say down with memorizing. I say
you have so many though that come just.
Yeah, well, out. I've never memorized a poem in my life. I have learned them by heart, and I do believe that if some scientist were to open me up or tie me to a machine or something, they would discover that learning by heart is an entirely different brain function than memorizing. The word memorize reeks of what a friend of mine calls educational trauma.
Rigid.
Right?
Yes.
You know, and
must be.
Even the suffix eyes, you know, I-Z-E, it's privatize, simonize,
graded,
capitalize. It
vulcanize.
Means to, yes,
judged.
Exactly.
Yes.
It means to have power over something in some way. And when you learn a poem by heart, it really is taking it into your heart as a teacher. And it's a collaboration between you and the poem, or it's even allowing the poem to have power over you. It's a discipleship to this poem that you love. When you find the poems that speak what I say, the language of your interior life, which I didn't for many years. I was terrified of poetry for most of my adult and early, late teen life. I was terrified of poetry because I experienced educational trauma in high school and college, which turned what was, really a magical, poetry was a magical thing for me when I was a kid, as I think it is for all of us.
Yes, it was.
You know, Dr. Seuss, I wish we could do what they do in Kitru. They sure know how to say happy birthday to you in Kitru every year on the day you were born. They taught the day bright in the bright early morn when the birthday honk honker hikes high up Mount Zorn. You know, and it goes on. And we all recognize it. Or Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet.
Yeah.
But then we start... I don't know. This is not true. I have to say, this is not true in all high schools today. But I think when I was growing up, and I think in many high schools today, but not all of them, suddenly that wonderland of poetry became a very linear left brain, iambic pentameters and dactylic tetrameters and rhyme schemes and sonnets and villanelles, all of which, if somebody had said to me, "We're going to learn about a consciousness-altering substance today, and it's called poetry." And this is how...
Can you smoke it?
We are going to smoke this stuff.
Oh, good.
And it is going to be wild, because the rhythms of the poem are going to entrain your brain waves, and the breath of the poem is going to infuse your breath with more oxygen than usual. And everybody has known since the beginning of time that if you take in more oxygen, you have an amazing trip inside.
So you're saying it changes the biochemistry of the mind.
Yeah. Nobody said that to me, but I would have been really interested in that when I was 13 or 14 or 16 or 42, you know. But nobody said that, and so I turned away from poetry, and I was really lucky to have a kind of miracle happen to me in the middle of a very, very very severe depression, a suicidal depression back in 94, when I happened to find underneath one of my radiators when I was cleaning my house a battered cassette tape, threw it in the tape deck, and the sound of this man's voice speaking poetry started filling my house, which was really a strange experience, because there was no name on the tape. I didn't know who it was. I didn't know where these poems came from. And these poems reached right in and touched me where no amount of therapy, no amount of... I was a therapist and a spiritual teacher at the time, but no amount of spiritual teachings or psychological teachings could speak to what was hurting in me. But these poems just opened me up, and you know how it is when sometimes when a wound opens, that's what it needs for the healing, you know? And that was the beginning for me. It turned out I finally found out it had fallen out of the purse of one of my clients whose father had just died, and somebody had handed her this tape saying, I think this will help you. And and it was a man named David White, who many people know his work now, but at that time he was really unknown. I looked him up in the phone book and I found him.
Seattle,
and I called him.
He
was from Whitby Island.
Yeah.
And he answered the phone. Those were the days. And he taught me a lot about, because he had been raised by, and I may have this wrong, but I think his mother is Irish and his father was Welsh, or the other way around. But he came from this lineage where the recognition that speaking great poems is a necessary nutrient to the human diet. The Welsh and the Irish know that as well as anyone in the world. And, you know,
you wrote about
I would say that just about any country in the world besides the United States knows this, whether we're talking, you know, Argentina or Brazil or Iraq or Iran or Jerusalem or, you know, Congo or Kenya. People understand, people hold poetry in most countries the way we luckily still hold music. We listen to music. Most of us listen to music on the radio every day, or, you know, we have our CDs.
I had interviewed a rabbi in Israel who spent a lot of time with the Bedouin. And he had spoken about the importance of the spoken word to them. And then I read about that in one of your pieces.
Yes.
How the Bedouin people know poetry. They may not be literate, but their poetry, they can pick it up and reiterate it. And it tells stories. And it's so much a part of who they are.
Yeah, that's
Can
beautiful,
you say a bit?
Yeah.
You spoke about it very well. And then the power of poetry to transform us within and without. And in the war zone in Iraq, there are freedom spaces that you were writing about where the Sunnis and the Shiites came together. And do you want to just say a little bit about that?
Sure, sure. My book... the foreword of my book is by a woman who's a force of nature. Her name is Eve Ensler. And she, among other things, she wrote, of course, her very famous play is The Vagina Monologues. And out of The Vagina Monologues, she started a worldwide organization to stop violence against women and girls. And that organization is called V-Day. And she's doing incredible work. And through my friendship with her, I've met some extraordinary people from all over the world who are working to help women and girls. And one of the people I met is a woman named Yanar Mohammed, who lives in Baghdad. And before what she calls the American occupation, she was a very well-respected architect. And they lived in the suburbs. And I don't remember. I think her husband was a university professor or something. And then the war happened and the occupation happened, and she saw what was happening to her friends and her colleagues, and women who were incredibly well respected were being forced into sexual slavery. They were being forced to cover their faces and their heads, and they were young girls from all different kinds of backgrounds were being forced into childhood prostitution. And she gave up her work as a builder, and she started an organization called the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, OWFI. You can find it on the web. And I got to speak with her. I didn't speak with her specifically about her work with the women. I spoke to her about something that happened kind of by coincidence, which is that the man who was guarding the place where they had their meetings apparently started eavesdropping. Huh. And this guy, this young guy named Adham, he had been thinking about being a suicide bomber himself. And his friends had talked him out of it. And in his not knowing what to do with his life, but feeling like he had to do something radical to stop what was going on in his country, he became a security guard outside this building. And he heard what the women were talking about. One day he went to Yanar. He said, "I'm a poet, and all my friends are poets. And we need a place to be able to speak poetry and do like a poetry slam competition. And I want your organization to sponsor it." And she said, "Well, that's crazy. We're an organization for women. We don't have anything to do with poetry." He said, "What I am talking about with my friends and what you are talking about with your organization is the same thing. Mm. And we need this, and this is what I'm doing to stop the war and to stop the occupation, and I need your help." And she said, "Okay, we'll try it once. And but my one stipulation is that there be equal number of Sunni and Shiite poets involved." So they set up a tent in this street that had been in a beautiful neighborhood in Baghdad, but now was just this bombed out space. And the Sunnis sat opposite the Shiites, and they thought it was going to be a competition. And by the end of each, a Shiite would recite a poem, and then a Sunni would jump up and go, "Oh my God, that's the same as what I wrote." And then they'd recite their poem, and they would be weeping together and embracing across the aisle together. And Yanar says in her beautiful accent, she says, "It was like ping pong poetry." And everyone found out they were on the same team. And so, to make a long story short, there's a number of stories in the book about individual poets in the freedom space. But to make a long story short, in 2008, on International Women's Day, there was, between then and 2008 and now, the freedom spaces just proliferated all over Baghdad and in the suburbs. And people would literally risk their lives to get to these events. And one of the primary poets in the first event was actually killed by Al-Qaeda for speaking poetry.
Oh, my word. So they are taking their...
It's against the law. It's against Al-Qaeda law to wear shorts, to educate girls, to speak poetry, and to have cigarettes. I don't really remember all of it, and I don't know if it's true now, but at that time it was.
Horrific.
So as Yanar said, at all the big Freedom Space events now, they always have a chair with his picture on the chair. And the Freedom Space event of 2008 had 1,000 people at it. And it was guarded by both Sunni and Shiite guards. And it was an extraordinary event. And my sense is that it's continued to grow since then.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
A real testament to the power
of poetry.
Of poetry.
To melt boundaries, which is really what it does in a way that nothing else can. No other language can. So that people who think I am separate from you in the face of a poem can't maintain that belief anymore.
No. And you were in Kenya. Do you want to speak about that experience? And you...
Sure, sure.
And this was a specific poem. Was it by Mary Oliver as well?
It was by Mary Oliver. I was, again, thanks to my friend Eve, who started a safe house there with a Maasai woman. Vide doesn't actually initiate things on the ground, but they find indigenous people who are already working to do certain projects on the ground, and then they fund and support and guide and work with these indigenous people. So this woman named Agnes Pariah is a Maasai woman who had spent her life walking from village to village in the Rift Valley, educating the people about female genital mutilation, which is a very core custom among the Maasai and many, many. I'm always startled to find out how many cultures throughout the world, not just in Africa, believe in what they call female circumcision, which is more accurately female genital mutilation. Mm. And Agnes was walking from village to village with this plastic model that showed people the medical hazards of female genital mutilation and speaking to them about how they needed to educate their girls and not marry them off to old men and mutilate them. And Agnes was making a difference when Eve and V-Day found her. Eve said, well, what can we do for you? And Agnes said, well, if I had a Jeep, I could get around a lot faster.
Very practical.
So first they got her a Jeep. And then what happened was that girls started running away because they were now educated by Agnes. They knew that they had choice. They started running away. And there was not a lot of places where they could go. And so Eve said, what else can we do? And Agnes said, well, we need a house. We need a safe house where the girls can come. So mm-hmm. I had always wanted to go to Kenya to visit this safe house. And I went for the first time in 2006 or 7. I get all the years confused. anyway, it was 3 years ago, whatever that is. And I'm a very shy person. I don't
you
sound
are,
shy right
not
now.
Not at all.
But socially, I'm shy. I mean,
okay.
Give me a microphone, I'm fine. But if you put me in a room, especially a room full of teenage girls who I really like and I really respect, but, you know, I just become a shy teenage girl again. And so I was trying to be brave and get to know these girls. There's about 50 girls living at the safe house. It's in Narok, Kenya. And now there's two of them, but at the time there was only one. And they were shy with me because they understand English, but they speak Ma and Swahili. And they were not, they were too shy to speak English with me. So we were all kind of looking at each other sheepishly and giggling. They eventually went off to make dinner, and I heard them singing and laughing and joking, singing so beautiful. They, you know, in the kitchen as they were cooking the dinner of ugali and cabbage. And so I screwed my courage up to the sticking point, and I walked over to the kitchen, and I walked in, and everybody went silent. And I thought, okay. And then this young woman came and stood right in front of me, and she said, do you remember my name? And I didn't remember her name. I had been introduced probably to 20 girls at that point.
For sure.
And so I pulled the only name I could think of, and I said, Salula? And the girls, like, shrieked with laughter, and they pointed at the youngest girl, who I later found out was 9 years old when she was saved, rescued in the middle of a forced marriage to a 42-year-old man. Mm. Agnes had been notified that this was going on, and she had arrived in the V-Day Jeep and saved Salula in the middle of her wedding. Salula arrived to the safe house in her wedding dress.
My.
You know, so the girls were laughing at me and pointing at Salula, who was, as I say, 9 years old. And the girl who had asked me said, I am Jacinta. She said, do you know any songs? And I said, well, I know some songs, but what I really love is poetry. And another girl from across the kitchen said, well, I write poems. And I said, do you know any of them by heart? Can you recite any of them? And she said, I am too shy to do that. And she's just so beautiful. And I said, Well, how about if I recite a poem, and then maybe you'll feel like you want to recite yours to me.
Sure.
And so all the girls got really quiet because, again, I have to say, in that culture, they understand poetry. Mm-hmm. They may not even be educated, but they mm-hmm. understand what happens when you, the power that happens when you speak a poem.
It's like a prayer.
Yes, yeah. So all the girls were very quiet, and I had no idea what I was going to recite. I mean, I know about 120 poems by heart, but all of them seem totally wrong for that situation because these girls are so different than I am. And then all of a sudden I thought of Mary Oliver's poem, The Journey, which I hadn't really thought of in years. And I just started reciting it, even though I didn't know if it would make any sense to them. And I'll recite it here.
Yes,
okay?
Please. I'm not familiar with
and,
it.
And as I recite this, just you have to imagine me standing in that kitchen surrounded by these Maasai girls who grew up in these tribal villages and had to leave their whole culture and their families and everything they knew and travel barefoot often for many, many miles to get to this safe house.
I really appreciate your vivid description of this experience that you're having. Mm-hmm. I can see it very easily and I want to hear
So this is The Journey by Mary Oliver. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice. Though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles, mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, and though their melancholy was terrible, it was already late and a wild night and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. It's a poem by Mary Oliver from her book Dreamwork.
How perfect that was for them to hear.
And they were stunned. They were weeping. They wrapped their arms around me. And then Jacinta comes up to me and she says, "Who is this woman, Mary Oliver? Is she Maasai?" And I said, "No, she's Mzungu," which means a white person, like me, American. And Jacinta said, "How did she know?" You know, and it was so profound. It was the most exquisite example of how, you know, Mary Oliver's a white, middle-class, middle-aged American poet. And these are Maasai girls who have grown up in mud huts with one cow. And, you know, their parents sell their daughters into marriage to these quote-unquote old men because the two cows they'll get in payment for their daughter is literally the only hope they have of survival, right?
It's barely fathomable, deplorable.
And yet Jacinta says, how did she know, you know?
It's poetry can transcend those arbitrary borders that we have. And those are two beautiful, beautiful stories about the testimony of poetry. And how did you come to, well, create or write this book? And How were you saved by poetry? You told me a bit about your story.
Well,
with the depression, but there's so many other ways.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to come upon that cassette tape by David White, who introduced me to a whole world, a whole universe of poems that I had never been introduced to in high school or college. And those poems opened me and spoke to me and got inside me. And what I learned, I decided at that point that I would start to do what David White did. I thought I was going to memorize the poems. And what I found out was that I wasn't going to memorize them. I was going to learn them by heart, which is a whole other thing. I think we were talking before the show about this, you know, where memorizing has the implication and the suffix eyes, which has to do with power over something. If you think of the words that have eyes, capitalized, privatized, simonized, you know, all those eyes words, it's about doing something to something else, as if I were going to do this to the poem. But learning by heart, and there's a chapter in my book called Writing on Your Bones, and I discovered a lot about memory. For instance, memory, taking things into your memory and learning them by heart was known to be a powerful mystical practice until about the Middle Ages. It still is.
It's just not common knowledge
anymore. Well, yes, exactly. But in until about the Middle Ages, any great philosopher or mystic had at the center of their practice the practice of learning things by heart. And the term writing on your bones comes from the earliest students of the Buddha who couldn't read or write. And so they would pass on the teachings of the Buddha by learning them word for word, and they called this writing on the bones because they were completely aware that this was causing biochemical shifts.
So there's the internal transformation.
Yes, yeah. It's not only internal on a spiritual, psychological level. It's actually a physical phenomenon that takes place when you take words that you love and that really speak deeply to you, and you take them into you. Maybe you learn them by heart, or maybe you just speak them the way some people read prayers over and over. The rhythms and the breath and the sound of those words are actually as impactful as the meaning of the words. Usually
it's
we think it's
too.
The meaning. Yeah. Usually we think it's the meaning of the words that's giving us the aha experience, but really that's not true. It's what I call it the shamanic anatomy of a poem. The levels of the poem that are entraining our biorhythms so that the brain literally moves into a different wavelength, and insight and revelation is possible in those wavelengths. You know, everybody's heard of the alpha and beta.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm not an expert on those things, but basically what happens is you move into alpha, even with a short poem. I'm nobody. Who are you? Yeah. Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to shout one's name the livelong day to an admiring bog.
Wow.
Really short poem by Emily Dickinson. But even within those lines, which are, you know, which are playful and funny, there's a pause, there's a breath that happens for all of us because of the music
sort of short circuits.
Yeah, it's a great way to put it.
Mind process.
Yeah.
We talked about that a little bit the last interview, but you've taken it to another level entirely.
Yeah.
Through poetry.
Yeah. So that's how the poems saved me. I started thinking I was going to memorize them. I ended up learning them by heart, or sometimes not learning them by heart, but taking them so deeply into my life that they became inner teachers. And at that point in my life, they were far more helpful to me than any of my outer teachers. And they, it was really like having a fleet of inner teachers inside me as I would learn these poems. And
how do you think that happened?
What happened?
Did it open up your mind to receiving the teachings from the poem by repeating it? How do you think that occurs?
Oh, it was many, many ways. What? It's a great question. I think as you learn a poem by heart, as opposed to memorizing it, you have to allow it to magnetize to the surface of your consciousness all your own personal material. So I would be learning these poems and I would be weeping in a way. I would be revisiting old, not old, but past heartbreaks. I would be having to enter into griefs that I hadn't felt before, or joys that I hadn't allowed myself to feel, or levels of my own being that were in the voice of the poem that I myself had quarantined myself from. And so all these feelings were moving in me, not to mention the rhythm and the breath and the sound, as we were speaking of before, that and train the mind. So you go into, we were talking earlier about, I think before the show, we were talking about how I wish that my teachers in high school had said to me, okay, we're going to learn about a consciousness-altering substance today.
Oh, no, that was here. We started.
Were we
yes,
talking
we
on,
on?
We were on. Okay, I can't. God help me. You know, this is hope for anyone who says they cannot remember a poem. I can't remember anything. But when you learn a poem by heart, it's a whole different function. That's what I was saying. I think, you know, I think scientifically it can be recognized as an entirely different brain function to learn a poem by heart. It has never helped me to remember where my keys are, but I do remember all these poems, and they are a great, great, great service to me.
I've never conversed like this about the power of poetry, and I'm utterly fascinated. Mm. I just want to hear more.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. And I know that you lead workshops in poetry. And can you explain a little bit about what happens?
Yeah, the workshops are not so much in poetry as they are in allowing poetry and other text that's sacred to you to open you to your inner life.
And how does that
You know,
happen?
When I turned away from poetry in high school, I started, you know, after doing many, many things, one of the things I did was I became a student of consciousness. I learned a lot about different kinds of therapy and a lot about different spiritual inner paths, and I became a teacher and a therapist right at the interface between psychology and spirituality. And I feel that what I'm doing right now, I'm not giving poetry workshops, although the workshops are infused with poems. There's there's wall-to-wall poems, both spoken by me and spoken by the people in the workshop. There's writing, there's a lot of music, an ocean of music really carries the whole experience. But really the essence of the workshop is, I like to think of it as allowing poetry to be the lamp that illuminates the inner life, that takes you close to the bone of yourself. So there
you have
is
such an eloquence with words.
Thank you.
Very vivid.
Thank you.
Keep
well,
on,
yeah,
no,
I'm really borrowing that, I think, from Natalie Goldberg, who says when you write, close to the bone as you can. And
she does.
And this is what I've been doing for many years, long before poetry came and reclaimed me. I was
it did indeed.
Yes, I was leading workshops in exploration of consciousness, and in a way I still am. And at the moment I'm very lucky. You asked me why I wrote the book. I wrote the book out of gratitude, because I felt like I'd found this consciousness altering substance that was a direct route home to my inner self, and a direct conduit between my inner life and my outer expression. Hildegard of Bingen says, when the inner and the outer are wedded, revelation occurs.
beautiful.
Isn't that perfect?
Yes, yeah. I'm going to have to write these down.
Yeah, well, that's later. The epigraph.
Well, I have it on the recording.
That's the epigraph to the last chapter of my book, Saved by a Poem. And so
which
I
just received yesterday. I can't wait to go home and read it. I wish I'd read it.
Yeah, well, I look forward to hearing how it is for you.
I'll have you on again.
Saved by a Poem is Hay House, the publisher, did a wonderful job because they include in the poem, in the book, a CD of spoken poetry and of people talking about the importance of poetry in their lives. People that many of us have heard of and respect, like Tom Moore, who wrote Care of the Soul, and Dr. Christiane Northrup.
Yes.
And
yes.
Andrew Harvey, who's a great visionary and translator of Rumi, and Janine Roth, and wonderful, wonderful teachers, wise people. And there's a few poets reading their own poems. But the book is not only stories about people who have been saved by poems, like the stories of the individuals in Iraq, mm-hmm. And many, many other people all over the world, mm-hmm. but it's also a map as to how you can find and really deeply receive a poem and allow it to transform you from the inside out. Mm-hmm. The subtitle of the book is The Transformative Power of Words, and it's woven with stories from my own life and my students' lives about how the different levels of taking a poem into your life, whether mm-hmm. or not you ever learn it by heart. I say that again and again. You don't have to learn it by heart mm-hmm. to receive many of the gifts, and there are special gifts if you do, but the gift of opening your voice to the poem, the gift of the fact that poetry...
So actually speaking it as opposed to just reading
yes.
it. What happens?
Yeah. So when you speak a poem, it comes even more deeply into your breath and your body, and you become a vehicle for the poem. And the fact is that every human being has in their voice the encryption of their life experience, mm-hmm. so that somewhere in the sound of your voice are the tragedies and wonders and conquests and defeats that you've lived. And when you bring that voice to a poem, it's going to be different than anybody else speaking that poem.
True.
And when you speak that poem aloud, even just for yourself, there's a medicine in the sound of your own voice that's healing to you, both from inside your body. I was talking with Dr. Christiane Northrup the other day, and she was talking about how the bones and the teeth and the fascia in our bodies are crystalline structures. And so the voice resonates the way, I don't know if you've heard these crystal bowls
that you can
play.
Yes, I have. I had someone in here playing them.
Beautiful,
afternoon.
Yeah. So really our body is a crystal bowl. And the voice resonates inside it. So, and there's a way that your own voice, the sound of your own voice, we're all told, oh, she loves to listen to the sound of her own voice. But I'm saying love to listen to the sound of your own voice, because there's a healing in your voice that you're not going to get from anybody else. And when you wed that voice with a poem that matters to you, that speaks the language of your being, there's a third thing created that blesses both you and also anybody who might be lucky enough to be within earshot.
Now, why couldn't we have been taught this in school about poetry?
Well, I think it's beginning to happen. Like, in 2 weeks, I'm going into the school, couple of schools in Marin County that are engaged in the Nationwide Poetry Out Loud contest, which is a new, relatively new thing. I think this is the sixth or seventh year. And it's a national poetry recitation contest.
Wonderful.
Like they never had, you know, it's like, do they still do these national spelling bees? I don't know anything about that.
I don't know. I assume
I've seen
so,
the movies about, there's some movies that have
they
come
They were torturous
out.
Though.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
Competition.
I think these are a little bit more awake and a little less torturous. And so high school students all over, like hundreds of thousands of high school students right now are learning poems by heart and preparing to speak them aloud in these competitions. And they're invited to choose these poems from a broad spectrum of poems. They're not just afflicted with the Odyssey and the Iliad and the Highwayman like I was.
Yeah.
They're given a lot of different choice. And I'm going to get to work with some of them in a couple
How
of weeks. I'm really
exciting.
Looking forward to
I
that.
I wonder if we can get you in Santa Cruz and the schools here.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm so excited about doing that. I really want to... I want to become a student of how many different kinds of people we can, how I can meet with so many different kinds of people through mm-hmm. the poetry that takes you, boom, right under the surface. Like you don't have to do the small talk thing, which I'm so bad at. You just boom, all of a sudden you're heart to heart.
Oh, yeah. I can see it just talking with you. I feel that. And what I want to ask you is what are some of your... favorite poems and why?
Well, let me think. One of them is one that's quite well known. It's a poem by Derek Walcott called Love After Love, and it was one of the poems that really saved my life, really, during that period when I was so depressed, and it still does every day, I have to say. Recite it on the CD that's included in the book. And I just want to ask anyone who's listening, would you, if you're interested in buying my book, you can get it all sorts of places, you can get it on the web everywhere, if you could possibly go into your local independent bookstore and ask for it, it would serve the independent bookstore and it would serve the book. It would be great if you would do that. I know there's some great independent bookstores in Santa Cruz.
There are.
And it
Bookshop
would be
Santa Cruz, Capitola Book Cafe.
Gateways.
Gateways
right.
is another one.
Yeah.
And that's Saved by a Poem, The Transformative Power of Poetry
yes.
by Kim Rosen.
Yes, yes. So,
get it out there. It's hard to find. I couldn't find it.
Yeah. Well, it's not on the shelves unless you order it in. So that's the great plot is to ask people to order it in. Yes. So that's one of my favorite poems. And then I have a few poems by Neruda, which are less known. One is about silence. He says, I want to know if you come with me past not talking and not walking. I want to know if finally we will reach no communication. Finally going with someone to see pure air, rays of light over the daily sea or a land-bound object, and having nothing to trade, no goods to furnish like the colonizers had, exchanging coupons for silence. Here, I purchase your silence, and I will give you mine with one provision, that we not understand each other. That's a poem by Pablo Neruda that I just love.
You know, that, for lack of a better words, that just blew my circuitry.
Yeah.
Because it brings opposites of what we expect. Ordinarily, yes. Coupons. Mm-hmm. Of what use? Of what purpose? Silence? Mm-hmm. What do you do with silence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The beauty.
This poem came, I discovered this poem when I was in the middle of a very challenging relationship with someone who we just couldn't understand each other. We couldn't get to the point where we were in a state of understanding, which I had always taken to be a state of communion. But this poem showed me that understanding is the booby prize, as they used to say in S. You know, that
yes, the booby
that
prize.
Communion is communion. And that my understanding was really a trying to colonize somebody else.
Yeah.
It was such a profound
wow.
poem.
That
yeah.
speaks volumes.
Yeah. Right?
Oh. Hold on. Do you want to repeat? Is there another one that you want to share right now?
Sure. Let me share Love After Love, which is by Derek Walcott. And I love to tell people that our president, Barack Obama, was caught with a huge volume under his arm when he was on his way into a very, very important meeting right after he was inaugurated. And everybody thought, oh, sure, it's a book of the law or something. But turns out it was the complete poetry of Derek Walcott. So here's the poem, Love After Love, by Derek Walcott. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life. It's a poem called by Derek Walcott called Love After Love. That's on the CD that's included with my book, Saved by a Poem. It's also on the CD that we played at the beginning of this show called Only Breath. And
Thank you.
If you want more information about such things, you can go to my website, which is www.kimrosen.net. I'm doing a number of workshops in the area and would be happy to see anybody there and share poetry communion.
And she's visiting in Santa Cruz. We're fortunate to have her in our midst presently. Kim, I really want to thank you. You've opened up my heart to poetry in a way that is new.
You're welcome.
And just beginning that exploration. Thank you so much for coming in here and being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you. Oh, boy. That was Kim Rosen, the author of Saved by a Poem, The Transformative Power of Poetry. And I know a little bit more about her story, and I wish we had more time, but hopefully we can do that again. But I'm also very excited about our next guests who have arrived. And we have here Michelle Doika and William Muir. They're two local artists who are going to have an art show this Sunday at Samadhi, and that is, Samadhi is an art gallery, and it's on Mission Avenue. I cannot read this without my glasses. Michelle, put on your headphones and read that to our listeners, please.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Okay, Samadhi is Life Inspired. An organization dedicated to hosting and enlightening events. And right now they're deeply involved with the 13 Indigenous Grandmothers Council and helping that get along all throughout the United States of America. And they're going to be hosting this show, which is for artists and their work. Let's see, we have Yeramo Arnana and Kit Skio and William and myself. So I'm going to go ahead and let William do a bit of talking about the show and our mission with it. And here he is.
I am real excited about this show, though. It's the Four Directions, and it's going to be ceremony, art, and the art is most unusual. And I'll shut up, and I will let William Muir speak for himself. And William, I understand that nature is a very strong part of your art, and you speak very eloquently for the land. And you create paper out of all sorts of material, and I would love to hear more about you. Michelle's been telling me stories, and please speak. Welcome, William.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I have been working with art in the area for 20 years since I moved to Santa Cruz, and I've been working with art for about 38 years or 40 years of my life or more. And the earth is a huge part of my life and of art and of Sumadi life, where the art show and the ceremony is happening.
What's Sumadi life?
Sumadi life is an official web store for the International Council of the 13 Indigenous Grandmothers.
The pronunciation. They're
a healing center and a life-inspired center. And it's a family who run this small healing center that helped connect the 13 Indigenous Grandmothers Council to the world. The 13 Indigenous Grandmothers themselves have a global alliance. They met on October 11th in 2004 in a Tibet House's Manila Mountain Retreat in upstate New York. That's the first time they met. And it is said that it was prophesized, and it was brought about through dreams. I was looking just recently. I'm not well-versed on them, but I have researched a little bit. They include grandmothers from Alaska, the Alaskan tundra, North, South, and Central America, Africa, Asia, they have a plan that wants to extend through seven generations. They meet for prayer. They meet for the earth. Their entire thought process is for humans in the earth. When I say prayer and ceremony, it has to do with all people. And expressly, earth, air, fire, and water.
Our elements.
Yes. They create our elements, they create humans, and they create the earth. We're all created of the same elements. So, through the dream, the 13 grandmothers came together, and Sumadi life is a part of that, what's happening there. The global alliance to bring the world into a healthier, cleaner thought process.
And I might add that proceeds from the show are going to be going for the grandmothers to help them on their travels.
Absolutely. And the veterans.
Ah, and you're a veteran.
I am.
Of what war?
I was all local. I didn't have to go overseas. It was a peaceful time of life. So I was non-combat related. Yeah.
But you're still a veteran.
I survived basic training.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm. That's what we consider truly making it. Just getting through basic training has changed your person.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, at some point I would like to have you talk about that.
Okay.
Come on. Today we'll do a separate show. Yeah.
Okay. I was lucky enough to meet Michelle through the Veterans Memorial Building.
I know she performs there a lot.
Yes, we've been
singing. She shares it with me.
Cool. We'll sing for you sometime if you'd like to visit.
I would.
You can sing with us.
Well, I think you don't know what you're asking. Let me just put it that way.
through our friends and through our meeting, the same thing the grandmothers are looking at, diverse cultures, lands, medicine, language, ceremony. To go as far as manners, protocol, common courtesy, things like that. Things that we're forgetting. We're singing songs from the 30s, the songs that are Americana, so to speak.
Down at the Vets Hall, we've been making that connection again, because there was a time in America where people were connected through songs, and even recently in our history, like in the 50s, people separated, where the younger people no longer wanted to sing the elder songs. And when you realize the power of singing together, you know, for the generations, or you know, for us, like as we know, singing lodge songs and being a part of, you know, far off culture that way, you see that somehow bridges us together as humans. So
The power of song. We just talked about the power of poetry, and it's the same. Mixing the two. Michelle's also a poet. You may be too, William. Yeah. Well,
symbols.
I'll have to come down. This is at the Vets Hall. When do you do this?
Wednesdays.
What time?
And then all day for William. He is
all day?
Yeah, we have a wonderful little group called the Tin Can Cheese Grater Band. And we've sung at some barbecues and had some fun. Three World War II vets
Love
are involved.
It.
So the last 172 Wednesdays have been a blessing. They've just been wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just...
I can't
just
imagine
life.
Doing that. What fun. Yeah.
But it leads... The artwork we've been doing has a lot to do with the land and with the people and with society and with what we're feeling about the earth. Michelle's had quite the experience with the indigenous peoples.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been involved off and on throughout my life, I'm remembering, for longer back than I recalled recently. The picture stories from many languages, be it hieroglyphs or cave paintings or... the designs on the American Indian paintings and symbols, be it the broken arrow or the sun.
Yes.
And for America, collages. As simple a collage will tell so much about a society, a person's family collage or a business collage. It's amazing what pictures will represent. I'm looking into the sacred images of the past now, deeper and deeper as I'm able to, and learn from the elders and nice individuals who will impart wisdom.
Well, what are some of the images? Can you share any sacred images and what you've learned? Or
I might mention on the flyer, William's art.
I have it right here.
Has a woman, earthbound, and over her floats the feather. And how you could see the feather, you know, to our understanding is healing and connection to higher spirit.
I see it right here.
Yeah, you begin to see how he's putting the images together so that it's understandable.
The feather is an energy symbol. It's a power symbol for the indigenous American people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm enjoying the triangle, the square, and the circle. Which is sacred geometry, and nearly everything is built from a square, triangle, and a circle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's amazing how often you'll find that in the world. I mean, everything. Earth, water, fire, and wind again. Amino acids, the sun, the lungs, and water. It's what is creating all of life right now. Mm-hmm. So bringing those into the paper. Paper's like living on a boat. It has dirt, it has plants, it has water. I never thought of that. Oh, it's wonderful. It's amazingly wet. It's quite a process. It's laborious, and it's just so it's just so native. It's taken me back. I really think it's one of the things that helped me.
Show Cindy your piece.
Oh, you brought it.
I did bring a vessel.
Indeed.
It's amazing when you think that indigenous cultures, all the way to Australia, built homes and clothing out of fibers. So to be that in touch again with...
It looks like a vase at first. And then it looks like there are little webs in here. Spider webs.
Plant fiber. Absolutely.
Plant fiber.
Leaves, pineapple leaves, day
lily.
You
teach a class in this.
I've been fortunate enough to be introduced with papermaking through Leroy Parker at San Jose State University, and he's brilliant. He's wonderful.
He taught you well.
A lot of knowledge. Yeah, there's also some world-class papermakers in Santa Cruz. It's a wonderful area for papermaking, actually, a hidden little wonder.
Learning a lot today. I don't know anything about papermaking. And this is art.
Absolutely. It goes in a lot of directions. It's art, it's clothing, it's textile, for sure. They call it a craft, technically. But yes, painting on it, sculpting with it, making wall hangings, room dividers, giant sheets of paper. I have a dream of a 60-foot square sheet of paper.
Wow.
Yeah. It would weigh a lot. Yeah.
You couldn't bring that in today.
I couldn't. No, that'll be a 2-year project.
This is lightweight, but fragile, and yet... No?
Mm-mm. No, paper's not fragile. It's like leather. You could crumble that, and it would come back.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll do that, though.
That's okay. I'm okay with that.
But I'm tempted. Be careful.
Yeah,
oh.
Yeah, it's.
Yeah, it is really solid.
You got to remember, people wore clothing out of fibers, so.
That's quite a piece.
So William brings both the connection to the mother through, well, grandmother's hair, or the fibers and the grasses, right? You know, that concept. So he brings both that and his collage and paintings into the show. A very strong influence.
Very symbolic.
And from the very first time I ever saw his work, I was really, really struck with his understanding of the female and the earth matter. So we're really lucky to have him.
Yes, we are. And how do these ideas come to you? Are they visions that you have initially, or?
I've been fortunate enough to be here in town 20 years, and after here 4 years, a son was born, for me and my partner at the time, and so he slowed me down enough to go to school for kind of like the first time in my life. And as I thought I was an artist and a writer, I soon found out I wasn't, and I've been in school without missing a semester for 13 or 14 years.
I'd rather do your art.
I'm finally doing my art, and they've been able to show me the details and the refinements to the techniques and all that, and to push our value studies and our color and design and line and edge and such.
What are value studies?
The difference between a saturated red, like a maraschino red or an earth tone red. Yeah.
I mean, I'm beginning.
Right, but you know maraschino cherry versus like a mauve.
I think so. No, I do.
Yeah, it's different. So,
don't wear them together.
I might.
I've been the people. Dr. Edward Stachowiak was a local in Carmel, and he just spent his whole life working in outreach. He founded a mud squad back in the early 70s.
What's a mud squad?
It was in Salinas, and it was outreach. We'd do magazine collections door to door as a kids, and he'd go to juvenile hall and do outreach. And he was a doctor, and he would, and it was like a phone network for runaways and such. And he was also already working with the American Indians back then, because actually in fifth grade I did a blood thing with a friend in Sacramento and became Chicken Hawk. I just recently remembered that. And I know that was his influence, because he was showing me ancient coins, and he was a good relative of my mom from the family, Edward Stachowiak. And he eventually was starting a think tank in Monterey, and he went to Fort Ord and became a doctor in the military so he could give his time to Fort Ord as a doctor. And he was like 50 when he did that, or just old, just barely like 44 years old. Yeah, he was a barefoot doctor. He gave his time to the Ohlone and to the Indians all around Hollister. He had the Christmas house. It was a giving house. He left his house mostly to the indigenous people in Carmel. He did. He gave it away. So I think he influenced me a lot. And the images, I've been painting collages since I looked back at my very first painting from Cabrillo, and it was a collage because a teacher said take magazine pieces and put them in one painting, four different images. And now what's coming through with the symbolism and the thoughts of community and life and wanting to see a better planet because of how I've grown up and the entertainment I've allowed myself to experience, so to speak. I've been trying to paint without being a graphic artist, without writing words, trying to say things and talk with images and life and bring my emotions to paint what I feel and what I see and what I want to paint. And it takes a long time for an artist to actually get on paper or on canvas or in sculpt what they vision. And so those kind of things, I think, are helping. I'm just finally being able to talk with my paints and my images. So, and then the influences from all these wonderful individuals around.
Michelle, and she had the original, I think, idea for the art show.
She
and
is
you've been
conceiver.
Working.
Yeah.
How did that come about? And then your shields. What kind of art?
Well, I was thinking about how to talk about this, and I realized that, you know, like life is a tapestry for all of us, right? You start weaving and sewing in one place and weaving and sewing in another place, and eventually things end up together. So I began my career in life as an artist, and I went back to school and began to study English and wound up doing a master's in English literature. And there I was studying Old English Lit and medieval literature. And, of course, really the primal concern in my mind the whole time was, well, what did the girls wear? You know, I was so into the thought of women, you know, back then. And
fashion.
One of the things I was really struck with is in Old English times, the women were the weavers. And although we have quite a bit of remnants of art handed down to us from that period, it's all war art for the most part. Well, not all. Some of it isn't, but there's an awful lot of helmets and swords and things like that where you will find these incredible images, and I was so drawn to them, and yet part of me wanted to understand, well, were women in this picture, because we have no fibers left to tell us about the women's art. So the very first shield that I ever created was actually a shield taken, or a picture, or an image taken from metal that I created into fabric sculpture, which is one way of saying it. I think that the art, if you look at it, I'll set one up here, is actually shield-like. Oh. It's round and it's curved surface on the top, only it's made all out of fabric. So that's part of the tapestry. And the second part of the tapestry is I went to a Sundance in Four Corners and went to stay for few hours in a site that was used for Humbleachia, and while I was sitting there, I just saw an image in my
head.
That's
Vision Quest.
Yes. And saw this image, and this image, this particular image is called the Singing Turtle Shield, and
it just came to your mind's eye.
Yeah. So I came home and I translated it into fabric as I had the other one, and wish I could say that I was really knowledgeable from the start, but really, no, you know, I saw a picture in my mind. I just translated it into fabric, and then a friend of mine looked at it and said, oh my goodness, that's the DNA strand you've put in there, and I had to go really kind of look that up for a moment. But basically, for those of you who can't see it, it's a picture of two turtles, and they are surrounded by the life-giving sun. And words from one turtle's mouth, or a strand of energy from one turtle's mouth, interlocks with a strand of energy from the opposite turtle's mouth. And those energies are holding their eggs of the unborn.
I see that now. Oh, my.
So basically what I came to understand through building it was really the power of our language, you know, how we use our language and our singing. As we mentioned earlier, how singing heals people, and the use of good words and good language, how that is going to impact the next generations. Although we might want to say, well, we have to get out and do this, or we have to get out and do that. On some very, very deep level, what we really have to do is speak loving, positive words about each other and sing more. Well, it's my opinion. But
I agree. I mean, okay.
You know, I would have to say that, you know, from the Four Agreements, when that teacher said, basically, you know, that words can be bad spells or good spells, and that they're very powerful. And even in the Bible, Jesus said words can kill. That we really can, maybe we can't get out there and stop a war automatically or stop destruction automatically, right, you know, at that moment, but we sure the heck can say pleasant things to other people and set the vibration of peace along, you know, flowing out through the channels of our everyday life. And, you know, what it really calls to my mind about how powerful words are, or words in a sense of prayer. I was down at the powwow, the Red Road powwow, and several years ago.
Yeah,
and they brought the hoop, the sobriety hoop, out from the Lakotas.
100 feathers.
Yeah.
Eagle feathers. So it just came to him.
There we are, you know, in California, walking behind the sacred hoop. And
that's
as
beautiful.
I'm walking along thinking about this, it struck me so hard I wept that I was actually walking in perhaps a 200-year-old prayer. Mm. That was somebody's prayer, that the Indians would stop drinking and that they would not fall into the ways of, you know, this consumer society, in a sense. Not that it's not wrong to have things, but, you know,
it's the emphasis that's placed on it, and like profit motive that's entitled,
or that we value ourselves. That, you know, children think that if they don't have certain things, that they're not as good as other people. And of course, as adult children, we bought into that too. But I think that part of my reason for wanting to bring this type of art forward is because, as William said, you know, we all hold these concerns about life. You know, things that bring us sorrow and things that we have questions about and things we feel unresolved about. But through our hands and our actions of creating, hopefully in this show, we've come to the point of come as four artists to put forward our best words about life and our understanding of spirit. Yeah, and our understanding of life in a good way. And so the basis of the show is that we've actually are going to try to build a what we intend to do is build a temple of art, you know, for the day. And Guillermo, he just does this beautiful, beautiful.
And what's Guillermo's last name?
Aranda.
Aranda.
He's a muralist from down in the Watsonville area of Azteca, responsible for the Azteca dancers and
White Hawk dancers. Yeah, he created that.
And his work is, you know, is about the world as it exists in totality, not just simply a physical plane reality, but the effect of the spirits and the effect of our actions. And so his work and William's work and Kit Skio, who does works with animal images and the feminine energy. So we're going to set it up as
Also fabric or what medium?
She's a painter.
She's a painter.
We're going to set it up in four directions, and the concept basically was like in the Mayan traditions, how their altars, they put everything beautiful on them.
And so your art is very much impacted by the Mayan tradition, Celtic.
So we're going to do candles and copal and flowers and art, and the last ingredient, you know, the last ingredient, sorry, will be the beautiful people that are going to come. And it is a ceremony. Anne-Marie Sayers from Indian Canyon is going to do the opening blessing.
Beautiful. And, she was on the program here once.
Just hope to send everybody through the last days of, you know, of the winter into a brighter solstice time. And I'm sure that's going to happen. I have good feelings.
Oh, yes. I have no doubt. And the people that are going to be there and those that you've invited specifically. And starting, do you want to say much about ceremony itself and how it will go?
Well, you know, it's always been taught that when people stopped doing the ceremonies that the earth would end. I think that that was one of the strongest images I had in my mind. But I do believe most strongly that we are responsible to feed that which feeds life. And that's a Mayan construct. And in that,
it's your construct now.
Yeah,
and part of all of ours. Thank you, Michelle.
You're welcome. And as we offer up to spirit, you know, the creator, the best that our hands can offer, and our beautiful words and the love in our hearts, you know, that's feeding what feeds life, because it goes out into the universe and everything is circular and circulating and it shows up somewhere else. So, ceremony is of great importance. When I first went on a Native American path, I saw ceremony in a sense as a way to disconnect from the physical draws of, you know, just daily confusion and get focused. And I thought about it like that for a long time. But now what I'm really starting to understand is ceremony is a way of remembering. You know, like that poem we heard when we came in, like, remember who you are. Remember that part of yourself. And when we do ceremony in any way, it brings us back to that that understanding that we were created in love by a creator that loves us, that we are beautiful, wonderful beings, and that as long as we participate...
With all of our relatives, with all beings.
Yeah.
The animals, two-legged. It's us, the four-legged, the winged creatures.
All part of the web of life.
Everything in the elements.
And, you know, especially... Well, not especially, because it seems like it's been going on for a really long time that humans have kind of stepped out of balance with nature and the natural balance. They've kind of stepped outside. And the part that ceremony plays, I really believe, is for us to step back into that place that we belong in. And as children of God, we are, you know, when we are celebrating life and spirit in each other, I think we are where we're supposed to be. And that's good.
And it is transformative. And I've learned that it brings balance back into our lives and into the land itself.
So maybe William would have something to add.
The ceremony, I'm really excited to be a part of. I grew
I'm
up
glad you
on an
too.
Air Force base. So I have a classic Air Force background up until about sixth grade when I was thrust into the real world. Our ceremony is not only the four directions, but it's humans, and it's animals, and it's nature. You can say prayer and you can say religion, and it's just energy is what we're really looking at, is positive energy and healing the world. Mm-hmm. It's a huge part of the 13 Grandmothers Council and of a lot of people's thought right now is healing the world, harmony and peace with nature. Northeast, south, and west, there's wisdom, there's innocence, there's trust, there's illumination, there's introspective thought and behavior. There's colors that set things off for people almost in every culture. There's so many overlapping things in the Azores.
Can you say a bit more about that? The color that sets things off in people.
I found in Chinese history right now, azure. The azure dragon of the east is for spring. And that was interesting because blue can be associated with winter also in the American Indians. But azure, I'm not sure. Is that a purple or is that a red?
I think it's
I should know as an artist.
Blue, that's what almost aqua, light sky blue.
Yeah, and
azul is blue in Spanish.
And for me, I've just recently gone through the fact that red is heat, anger is
cold.
Anger, real anger is cold. So anger should be associated as blue, because
white
is real hot though. White is hotter than blue heat. White can cut through things.
Well, I think that.
Of course, water cuts better than fire.
If you look at all the different cultures and how they use color. I think, you know, it'd be pretty much safe to say that it doesn't matter if one culture saw it one way and another culture saw it another way. I think the fact that they saw something, you know,
that
they recognized a vibrational quality to energy. And so
maybe it depends on where you are on the planet.
Could
the
well
color
be.
It's just a guess.
Well, and the trees
significance
change
changes.
And the rocks change colors.
Yeah.
Everything.
So, of course, they would change as the seasons change and as you change where you are located on the planet.
I always liked that in the Chinese courts, they would say that at certain times a year in the emperor's courts, everybody was required to wear a certain color. And I thought about that. I go, well, can we do that? We do that in America. It gets winter. We wear black. And I thought, well, that's wrong. You know, it's cold out there. And, you know, it's like depressing. We should be wearing pink.
Be colorful. Bright ourselves up.
You know. But if you thought about a culture that probably studied the effect of colors, you know, and then they say, okay, it's time now. Everybody get in yellow. You know, it'd probably be like, okay, they needed the cheering up or they needed another influence.
They paid more attention to that.
Yeah.
As a
whole.
There
you go.
Yeah, because little groups do, and it makes a difference. I mean, they do it in architecture all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a science.
That's what you mean.
Well, and I also,
for sure.
I think I was also going to back, I'm getting lost in my thoughts now. Back to
That's allowed.
the Celtics and the fact that there is energy in the trees, in the Yupik people in Alaska, they are still getting their language into writing. It's been a storybook. It's been a picture and a spoken language for ever since the Yupiks and the snowshoe setters. They're the synonymous, but the Alaskan indigenous. When you come up with things that haven't been written down yet, you're dealing with colors and you're dealing with animals and you're dealing with images and stories.
So that pre-verbal.
Those are what, I mean, for them, you definitely go into a tree or into a bear or into a wolf and you will go on.
So that language is creating a barrier to the real essence of something else.
Something about how the Mayan people, forgive me if I misquoted or anything, but basically in the Mayan language, there's four levels of language, and the Maya didn't use language, like they didn't just call something a dog, they called something by its function at the lowest level, and then from there it elevated into more elaborate poetic descriptions. And so I think that old language, like old English people had the same thing too, and the older a word, the more value it had because it had come from the ancient past, you know, from the beginning, from wherever the beginning was. And so for the old English people, they didn't like just make up new words as they went along, so they would combine words if they needed, like the ocean to them was the whale road. And so there you have that sense of that poetic.
You know what it is, too.
And you're describing its function.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, there's a lot about language that we've kind of just not seen, that in the remembering, you know, of ancient cultures, I think it's really important that William brings that up, that there's probably more depth there, more understanding and more wisdom than, you know, than we know. And unless you just wanted to say, looking at our behavior, you know, it's kind of an adolescent culture.
We
need that, you know, we need that grounding in understanding where what people thought and believed and what they held sacred a long time ago, because we're sort of a little bit off the track here.
Well said.
What I caught there that I heard, one of the things that brought to my memory is that one word can mean 20 things or 30 or 40 or 50 things now, depending on what neighborhood, what state, or what city you're standing in.
And the context.
The context is a whole other thing. It can go context, income, where you're standing, where you're not standing. But words have been destroyed, for sure. And emotions are running rampant. It's okay, we won't go there right now.
I'd like to say one thing.
Next time.
When you think about all of humanity, if you were to imagine a circle, and that each point on the circle faced directly into a center, that every single point could see clearly into that center from wherever they were. Now, if Creator or God or, you know, the great intelligence that rules the world was that center, then from anywhere on the circumference, anyone could see it clearly. And that over time, I think some of the confusion that we've had with religion and beliefs and understanding people is that someone standing on one edge of the circle says, this is what it should be. This is, you know, this is the concept of God, or this is the concept of the Creator. And another person standing over says, no, it looks like this, you know, from where I am. And interestingly enough,
Three men that saw the elephant.
There you have it.
It brings to mind.
So I think that another purpose for you know, this experience, this event, is to recognize that every person has a clear visual into the Creator. It's like that statement, you know, from I do believe Black Elk said it about the center of the universe is inside of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And that wherever you're standing, you can you're clearly connected. And instead of disagreeing about what we see,
yeah,
we need to just kind of look at how other people see things. Like, well, how did the Chinese see this? And how did the Lakota yeah. see it? And how did the Mayan
empathy.
People see it? Yeah, because, you know, like, you know, just a universal intelligence, whatever created us in this, you know, the galaxies, right? He must have known that we would need to see it from many different points of view in order to really get the whole.
And I see the four of you bringing your art pieces and giving us an opportunity to see different, see through the eyes of the Creator in a different way. Words are escaping me. You're encompassing so much, and through your symbols, much will be learned and gained just through the imagery.
You can walk in or out of
it. You can tell the work that's gone into it. Yes, you can.
I'd like to.
And each one is so unique.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I don't want to forget to do this. I just want to put out a word about Akasiana Bars and Samadhi.
Samadhi Life.
I have to tell you that I went there.
She's the owner.
Yeah, founder.
Founder.
And,
I suppose owner could be used too, but founder sounds.
You yeah, know. Founder. Owner.
I showed up there to hear Grandmother Flora de Mayo, and I went in and I looked around, and almost from the very first moment, I just knew that that was the place I wanted to bring my work, and Akasiana did that. She
I know that's right, because you've been looking for a place. Not, I mean, you knew when it would appear.
So I need
you
to say that
you kind of knew when this was.
I might have had the idea, but she was the one that made this happen and opened a space and just put all her good energy towards the creation of this show, and just to have a lot of thankfulness in my heart towards her for being standing up
yeah.
like that as a woman in the world. And she and her husband are good people. And I want to say thank you if you're listening.
And what's there? What goes on there ordinarily, and what they sell?
Yes.
Products and have workshops and lectures and the what
voice,
goes on there at Samadhi?
The voices of the 13 grandmothers.
Yeah.
I've only heard lullabies and stories. It's a CD that I purchased myself, and their images are amazing. If you close, they're just amazing. They're from the earth. You can tell. And I can honestly say I don't know, except they do a lot of outreach and travel, and they're supporting the 13 grandmothers. But Michelle, but real quick before we answer that, with the thanks to Akasiana Bars, I'd also like to thank Michelle for sticking with it for so many years and wanting
yes.
to do this and finding Akasiana and that space and seeing the artists and having that vision while we're on, because Michelle, without her, I wouldn't have. I mean, I found my art, but she wouldn't have found me and all this
stuff. Through the
stuff
music
is,
in front
yeah,
of the
oh,
vets.
Oh, it's going to be great. Yeah. Oh, well,
that's for you too, Matt.
Sacred. The it's been 180 weeks. We've been singing every Wednesday, and it's
such a dedication.
It's
grows the energy
community
each week.
It's really building. We had a gathering last night of a good 34
Wednesday night
exciting people, and they were. It was just
down.
This roar of good talk and friendship.
And if you can't sing, can you just kind of hum or tap your foot? Or
we're off key intentionally.
I'll feel comfortable.
We're having fun. Oh yeah. Yeah. So now we were on a conversation about,
yeah, about
Akasiana.
Yes,
you want to know about
her.
The grandmothers. Okay, so I'll just tell you what I know. When I went to hear Grandmother Flora speak, they had for sale the tapes, and they got they have a movie out now, some different things. But the thing that really struck me was that they had a plant oil, like they called it the grandmother plant oil. And, you know, she put it on our wrists, and we did a guided meditation. And, You know, I thought about it for about a month, and then all of a sudden I called Acacian on the phone. I go, I want to buy some of that. And what I did was, I guess the story is, I hope I didn't say this out of my own imagination, but that the plants down where she lives told them which plants to mix together to allow you to really kind of journey back to the first self, you know, the first world, or to journey and vision.
So they're shamanic in nature.
Yeah, but nothing intense. I mean, it's not intense. She put on our wrists, we laid down, and then we just kind of journeyed for a little while, for an hour, and saw things. And in the process of being curious about it, I have used it on numerous occasions, and I've asked questions like, well, what could you tell me about healing, and what could you tell me about my purpose on earth, or whatever. Ask, and they will have that up there. They do amazing. Sell that, so that's something that the grandmothers do to help them on their way, and
on their journeys, their physical journeys when they're
but I found it to be a wonderful way to step inside. And I would like to, definitely like to say that...
We don't step inside enough, is my feeling. Yeah. And we're ripping ourselves off.
Yeah.
So anything to assist in that?
It's so hard nowadays with marketing and...
I know.
And the use of the number system is pretty dangerously misguided at this point. As far as...
You mean the true meaning of numbers?
How they could be used for intentional goodness and not sensationalizing emergencies and global warming and such. We use numbers very...
Statistics.
All numbers. All numbers on the planet. I mean, the post office uses numbers and they don't miss a letter virtually. They lose no letters. But we use numbers in the government, and we're going to... You know, the world's crashing, we're in debt, we're overpopulated.
Yes, I agree.
We numbers are a very simple system of balance, and if we reset that system of balance and impress realism instead of sensationalism, then we can make this earth a calmer place just by talking to each other instead of sensationalizing each other.
Yeah.
And
separating and labeling.
Oh, we've got books, movies, DVDs, CDs, anything you want to name that shows what other cultures have created and done in the past. Even our culture.
That's the truth.
We've got tons of wars on our past cultural, and we don't let history repeat itself. We as humans repeat ourselves. And we're doing
history.
It brilliantly now. We're repeating ourselves. History is just a word to take us. It's a word that avoids self-integrity.
I have to borrow that sometime.
That's where all my art's going. I have a very voyeuristic series also. I'm not only about the earth. Yeah, I have a pretty serious...
Fascinating.
Yes.
Well, I would have something to say about...
Yes.
I think it's time to slow down.
Okay. Yes,
I think that, no, not us. But in general in life, just slow down, put your feet in the water. You know, the earth machinery, according to the one Mayan translator, said that the earth machinery it's going to stop. And the thought of that was just so amazing to me, because I thought, ooh, it's going to stop. And then I thought, well, what's going to happen next? And I realized that in the process of there being much less money, and perhaps all much less work for me sometimes, that really the quality of my life has improved 100-fold. Like William says, you have more time to talk to people. And if I have a day off work where I'm not working or not called in, then goodness, you know, I find myself doing things that I think are really of value sometimes. Helping people across the street that can't make it by themselves, when I would have probably walked right past them if I had been, you know, tired from work, you know. And, you know, just slowing down enough to say to someone on the street, you know, you look great in that color.
You made money at one point, and it slowed down right now, and you've slowed down, and it sounds like you're richer for it.
I'm liking it. I would have
you're
to say.
You're able to fulfill this vision of the art show.
Yeah.
And it's much, much more in the process, meeting William and so many other people.
Do we need to say anything more about how to find samadhi on Sunday? Okay. Do you want to do that?
I just have the address, but do you want to give it? I'm not very good with directions. Do you want to give the exact directions?
I'm okay. I've been here a while.
I have been here a while.
I did find their mission statement. Samadhi Life exists to provide resources and community for people as they connect and journey through cycles of spiritual growth and evolution.
Mm-hmm. And she's doing it.
Yes, she is. Samadhi Life is the parking lot level of the largest building on the left as you're leaving Santa Cruz on Mission. If you're on the highway, you can see it. It's a very large 100-yard by 100-yard building, about 2 or 3 stories tall. If you make a left as you're leaving Santa Cruz north on Highway 1 at Swift or at Western and make an immediate right, you'll be on the frontage road paralleling Highway 1 going north.
Which is Mission.
Which is Mission frontage. That road, as it goes into the dip before it gets to the beginning of the bike trail, the large building parking lot is on your right. It's almost impossible to miss. You drive out north on Highway 1, which is Mission, and the frontage road on the left-hand side, you'll find the, I believe it's called the Drascom Building.
Yeah. The Drascom Building.
Yes.
And ceremony will start at 3 o'clock, so if you're coming, try to get there maybe a little earlier.
And then you can look at the art, too, and her products. And
yes. And
start meeting all the interesting people.
Yeah.
And sharing stories.
And then when the ceremony starts with Anne-Marie Sayers, who's coming up from Indian Canyon to do the opening, blessing. Mm. So lucky
to
have her.
I know. She doesn't get out here very often. It's quite an honor to have her there, too. And she's, I consider her the matriarch of the California Indians. So she's the matriarch of our land here in California.
Yeah, she is our indigenous grandmother.
Mother. Yeah, grandmother. Absolutely.
Although she's not a grandmother yet.
she is to all of us, though.
So, yes, I'd say if you could get there, you know, quarter to...
Quarter to three.
We can be settled. Yes. Meaning quarter to three. Thank you, Cindy. So that everybody settles, parks, and can be in there when the ceremony, opening ceremony begins. That'd be good. And William, in his brilliant thinking, is telling me, Michelle, you didn't give him the address.
Yeah, we could give him the... So if you want to... If y'all want to... What's called MapQuest. 3004 Mission Street, Suite 170, Santa Cruz, California, 95060.
And are you going to be making music there as well?
There'll be great music and word.
Wonderful.
And, yeah. We'll have drums.
Acasiana's
food.
Husband.
Yes.
People always. It's
going to
be a great celebration
of
art and life. It's a non-religious event. It's for the earth.
It's truly ceremony.
Yes. Yeah. It's ceremony for the earth and for us.
I am so thankful to you for doing this, for holding on to that vision, and now it's coming to fruition. I can remember watching you create the weavings.
So here, I'll hand it to you. Hold it against
your
body.
Thank you. And it is a shield.
It is
protection,
a shield.
But it's a female. It's not metal. It's fabric.
Yeah.
Soft and beautiful.
Like
and it's Turtle Island right here. Well, I want to thank you both. I've got to put on Palestinian news. It's that time of the week. People wait for that. And then I get called if it doesn't come on. But I know many will be there this Sunday, starting at 3. Is there anything you want to say just before we...
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Cindy. Thank you for having us on the show and letting us bring this to people's attention.
Thank you.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, December 17th, 2009. The Israeli military removes a checkpoint from the West Bank and allows goods into the Gaza Strip. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.